Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hey everyone, this is AJ Woodhams, the host of the War Books Podcast, where I interview today's best authors writing about war-related topics. Today, I was so excited to get to talk to author and journalist Simon Parkin about his new book, The Island of Extraordinary Captives. It's about British internment camps in Britain during World War II, a topic I knew nothing about, and we had such an interesting conversation. Simon, he's a great writer. Super knowledgeable about what went on in Britain in the internment camps during World War II. And I was so glad that he agreed to come on and talk a little bit. Here is that interview, and let's get going. Hi, everyone. I am here today with author Simon Parkin, who just wrote the wonderful new book, The Island of Extraordinary Captives, a painter, a poet, an heiress, and a spy in a World War II British internment camp. Simon, how are you today?
Hey, I'm really well, thanks, AJ. Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on. Really loved your book. Super excited to talk about it. Maybe first, if you wouldn't mind, just tell me a little bit about your background and why you chose to write about this.
Yeah, sure. So I am a journalist by profession. And that's what I've done for the best part of two decades as a freelancer. So I write for newspapers and magazines and websites. I'm a contributing writer for TheNewYorker.com. And I've written for Harper's in the States and a bit for the New York Times. And then here in the UK, I mostly write for The Guardian for their long read section. So that's, you know, long form reported pieces. And yeah, I wrote my first narrative nonfiction book in 2019, which was a World War II story. I sort of cover as a journalist technology, but also video games. I write about lots of things, but the first thing I started out was writing about games. And so this book, which was called A Game of Birds and Wolves, was about a group of women in the Women's Royal Naval Service in the UK who worked on a war game that helped Britain understand why we had such catastrophic losses in the Battle of the Atlantic. And I suppose, you know, writing a book about the Second World War, I was allowed to do that because I knew lots about games, and that sort of got me through the door to write that. And then having written a book about the Second World War, then you're allowed to do another one. That's sort of how it seems to work in publishing. And so, yeah, the book that I'm here to talk about, The Island of Extraordinary Captives, it came about really because I was interested in POW camps in Britain during the Second World War. And I'd heard about this particular camp in the Lake District, which is this really picturesque part of England, all around lovely lakes, you know, very green. People go walking there. People, you know, go on holiday there. And there was a stately home there in the 1940s that was converted into a POW camp where any U-boat captains and officers who were captured by the British were taken to this stately home. And, you know, that struck me as a pretty cool location for a story. And so I'd gone to the National Archives, which is our big you know, data where all of the records from the Second World War are kept in South London. And I was researching POW camps. And it was while leafing through one of these folders that I came across a handwritten, sort of like a fanzine, you'd call it today, but it was a handwritten newspaper full of illustrations and, you know, write-ups of theatrical performances and things like that. And it was all written in English, but it seemed to have been written by Germans who were, you know, behind barbed wire here in the UK. And despite this, it sort of included a letter from the editor saying, tell everyone that you hate the Nazis. And so, you know, it was quite an arresting document. And I thought, what on earth is this? Who has made this? And, you know, and that led me into the world of internment during the Second World War here in Britain, which is, you know, a well-known story in the States. The internment of Japanese nationals is something that's, you know, well understood, I think, in among the American population. But the fact that the British government interned nearly 30,000 German, Austrian and Italian citizens in 1940 is not very well known in the UK.
Yeah, I had no idea.
That is like, that's a yeah. piece of history that's sort of been not suppressed, but it's just not something that's taught in the UK.
Even in the UK, that history is not well known?
I mean, it's well known among people who live on the Isle of Man, which is where a lot of the internment camps were. But yeah, I think you could stop probably, you know, 50 people in the high street and maybe one of them would know about internment here in the UK.
So give us a little bit of context then for Britain just before World War II and right at the outbreak. What was going on in British society? What were some of the attitudes of the British people towards the Germans?
Well, you know, I suppose the story starts in 1933 when the Nazis come to power and they start expelling anyone with any Jewish heritage from positions of power and from educators. You know, if you were a lecturer in a university or an academic, then you were kicked out of your post. And so immediately you've got a group of people in Germany who are looking to you know, for refuge, for asylum in other countries. And many of them try to come to Britain. And there are some efforts to help them, certainly among, you know, academics were found positions in universities here in the UK. And so it was relatively easy, I suppose, if you worked in that field to get into the country. But for, you know, as the 1930s progress, you know, more and more people are trying to leave Germany. And in fact, the Nazis are trying to kick out as many Jews as they can because they want to take all of their money and their belongings and their businesses to fund their plans. So there's this huge number of refugees who want to come to Britain. In fact, only a very, you know, relatively tiny number of people come to Britain. Around 73,000 are granted refuge, despite the fact that there were millions of case files of people trying to get in. And, you know, there's a sort of, I suppose, as you might imagine would happen today, there's a wariness about letting lots of refugees into the country. That would absolutely be the case.
Yeah, right, I read that and I was surprised. You had written at one point that attitudes in Britain weren't so dissimilar towards Jews, weren't so dissimilar to attitudes that were in Germany. There was a lot of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, there was anti-Semitism, and it was sort of across the political divide because on the left, there was a lot of pressure from trade unions. There was obviously a great deal of unemployment in the UK at that time. And so there was a fear that suddenly if lots of skilled labourers were coming into the country from Europe, then, you know, British people would be unable to find jobs. So, I mean, you know, you can imagine all the arguments that happened today were precisely the same arguments that were happening then. But I would say, you know, there was a sort of general acceptance of refugees who did come to Britain during that time. You know, there wasn't any mass suspicion in the years leading up. That all starts to change, obviously, with the outbreak of war, when suddenly there's a realization that, you know, tens of thousands of refugees have come from Germany and from Austria, and that there's a possibility that some of them may in fact be posing as refugees and could be spies sent by the Gestapo or whoever. And so the British government in November 1939, as a way to sort of mitigate those risks, says that anyone who's come to the country during the previous 6 years has to stand in front of a tribunal to basically give an account of themselves, to tell their story, how they came to Britain and why they came to Britain. And then a senior member of the British judiciary will ascertain whether they think that they're telling the truth, whether they are genuine refugees from Nazi oppression, or whether they are in fact, you know, spies posing as refugees.
And the people on this tribunal, their attitudes are probably a reflection, I think you write about this, of kind of the general xenophobia of the anti-Semitic attitudes. It's really not a, I don't know, fair is the right word, but it's not really a great tribunal, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that it would vary from place to place, and in some places you would have judges who were well equipped to make those calls. But there was, in fact, you know, this is not my judgment. You know, years on, at the time there was a government inquiry into the tribunal process that sort of was quite critical and said, look, many of the people making these decisions were completely oblivious to the political situation in Germany, didn't really understand, you know, what the forces at play. So, you know, they, as you say, they weren't all well equipped to make these decisions. But anyway, the decision that they were making was to categorize the refugees standing in front of them. Were they a category A? So that is high risk, that they're either probably a fascist or probably a communist, in which case they should be immediately interned and taken off the streets. Or a category C, which was no risk at all. This is a genuine refugee from Nazi oppression. And then the category B, which was sort of the one where they were unsure. And each category was subject to different restrictions. You know, if you were a category B, you couldn't own a bicycle, you couldn't travel more than 5 miles from your home, or own a map, things like that, or a camera. But anyway, these are the measures that the government puts into place toward the end of 1939. And
now,
they sort of...
How many people for these tribunals, how many people were hauled before the tribunals?
I think it was 55,000 had been through tribunals by the start of 1940. I'd have to double check that, but it's around that. So it's a large number of people.
And
it's the majority.
These are mostly foreigners. What types of people are these?
So the classification, which is the same one that was used in the United States until the Biden administration outruled it. So it's the official category is enemy alien. So that is someone living in your country who holds the nationality of the country with whom your nation is at war. So in this case, it was Germans and Austrians. And then from the beginning of June 1940, that includes Italians as well. So yeah, anyone who is
said that same category existed up until just recently here in the United States.
I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. The American government said they'll never again use the term enemy alien because it's demeaning. Which I agree with. I think that's the correct decision. It's right. Particularly when applied to refugees, this was also, you know, really some of the problem in the building xenophobia towards refugees that starts to happen in the beginning of 1940, because that term enemy alien, I mean, it sounds quite frightening, right?
Yeah.
You know, despite the fact that these are people, you know, who in many cases have left their lives, their livelihoods, their savings, they've been stripped of their belongings. You know, they are the very definition of people who need asylum and need help.
Yeah, and so one of the anecdotes that you write about in your book, so there were the British authorities thought that there were fascist plots everywhere. And one of the anecdotes that you write that I mean it's, you know, it's kind of like a, it's not really a funny anecdote, but it's just like you write about how there was a detective who found somebody's diary, and in the diary it's written that they wanted to substitute the British queen for an Italian queen.
Yes.
And come to find, and the authorities took this as subversive writing that, oh my gosh, like this is like the beginnings of a coup attempt. Come to find out, it was a beekeeper who was talking about the queen bee and his hives. And you give some other anecdotes too. And I thought that was just, that's so incredible that people, the attitudes, people can be so afraid of you know, plots everywhere that are trying to overtake the country. And I think there's
another one from a young art historian called Klaus Henriksen, who was a great source for my book because he wrote his diaries and very useful. But yeah, the police come knocking because one of his neighbors has reported him because she believes that the knocking of the bed when Klaus is making love to his girlfriend Gretel contains a coded message. And as Klaus points out in his diary, it's very difficult to convince a police officer that you don't actually understand Morse code.
I remember reading that too. Yeah. I thought that was so fascinating. I mean, it's awful, but it's, you know, really just like telling of the attitudes going on at this time in Britain. Well, let's talk about then. Let's talk about the internment camps. So, your book specifically is about Hutchinson Camp. But as we talked about at the very beginning, there are a lot of camps in a lot of different countries right now for people who are perceived to be, you know, working with the enemy. Tell me in Britain around this time, what's just like the how many camps are there? You know, what are these camps like? How big are they?
Yeah.
Where do people eat and sleep and just kind of give us an overview of the camps?
Well, I mean, it's worth saying that really until May 1940, it's only people who have been categorized A's, like I mentioned before, who are sent to internment camps. And they're sent to, for example, Kensington Olympia, which was a very big exhibition hall in central London. So they're sent to places like that. That all changes in May 1940 with the fall of France, because suddenly it's much more likely that the Germans are going to invade Britain. And in fact, you know, the British government is distributing leaflets that say what to do when the enemy arrives. So it's pretty widely understood that Britain's going to be invaded any day now. And that's really one of the things that changes the government's policy to become much more strict. And so throughout May, you see this escalation in the people who must be interned. So one day, all of the category Bs, right, you've now got to be arrested and taken off to camps. And then, you know, from mid-May, it's also category Cs. So everyone who had previously been judged to not be a risk at all, they also now need to be arrested and taken to camps, including women and children as well, who were taken to the Isle of Man. So suddenly, all across Britain, there's this need for internment camps that are going to house these people, nearly 30,000 of them. The Isle of Man, which is a small island sort of in between Liverpool and the coast of Ireland in the Irish Sea, there about in the middle, is chosen as the ideal site for internment camps. It had also been used during the First World War for this purpose. And so 10 camps are established there. But there are also camps on mainland Britain as well. So some of them, for example, there was one very notorious camp called Wharf Mills in Lancashire. This is where what's known as a transit camp. So once the policeman comes and knocks on your door and bundles you into a van, you're taken off and you go to one of these transit camps like Wharf Mills for a couple of weeks. This was an old disused cotton factory. It had been abandoned for 10 years. The British Army move in just, I think, 9 days before the first internees turn up. So you can imagine it was not fit for human habitation. There were, I think, 2,000 men sharing hardly any bathroom facilities and lying on lice-ridden mattresses. You know, it was some of the people that are being interned are 60, more than 60 years old, and have pre-existing medical conditions. So it's really a terrible place to be. I think Wharf Mills was probably the worst of them, but there were others that were similarly not unfit for human habitation, I think you would say. And of course, because you've got lots of very qualified, eminent German doctors among the internees, because of the kinds of people who have left Germany in the years leading up to it, they're able to note all of this down and the terrible conditions, and you know, are very well educated about the situation there. After you'd spent a couple of weeks in one of these transit camps, you'd be taken probably to the Isle of Man, to one of the 10 camp main camps that are established there. And they varied. Some of them were in hotels around which barbed wire had been put. Hutchinson, which is the main camp that I write about in my book, was around a sort of picturesque boarding square of boarding houses, which is where holidaymakers typically would go and spend their summers in peacetime. But barbed wire is put up around this enclosure, and then the men move into these boarding houses that would typically, I think, take you know, 6 or 7 people when they were boarding houses, but now have more than 30 men, you know, 5 or 6 to a room, cramped together, lying on the floor. So yeah, pretty cramped conditions, but better than perhaps what they'd had before.
These are just the transit camps, or these are the actual internment camps?
No, so yeah, the ones on the Isle of Man are the long-term camps where you'd end up. And as you mentioned before as well, there was also a big drive to send as many internees as possible abroad. So a deal is struck with Canada, which agrees to take a few thousand of these internees, as well as German POWs. And the ships start leaving in June 1940, but they quickly come to an end because of a notorious incident when the SS Arendora Star is sailing from Liverpool across to Canada and is picked up by a U-boat, which torpedoes the ship, and it sinks with, I think, 650 people died in that wreck. So once that happens, and there's, you know, the outcry at what's happened in Britain, the sort of internment, but the government policy of shipping off internees to Canada and to Australia is reversed, and then internees are only being held in the British Isles and the Isle of Man.
So how are there just the two camps on the Isle of Man? How many camps are in Britain?
No, there were 10 camps. There were maybe a couple more very small ones that only lasted for a couple of weeks. I think there was one called Granville. But yeah, for sort of in the long-term establishment, there were 10 camps. And as the war progresses and people start to be let out, that number reduces. And Hutchinson remains one of the last internment camps still functioning. Yeah.
Now, you had just mentioned this that I'm curious about, that at least one of these camps, maybe more, were used during World War One as well.
It was different sites, but yes, the Isle of Man was used for internment purposes during the First World War as well. It was slightly different.
Not the same site, though.
Not the same site. They were under tents, I think, in the First World War. But there were, you know, similarly poor conditions, and there was a riot during which a number of internees were shot by British soldiers. And the whole episode had been so terrible during the First World War that actually afterwards the government says, never again are we going to repeat the internment measures. And then, you know, lo and behold, not that many years thereafter, it's all repeated, and on a much greater scale as well.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, so your book really focuses, so the title, or the subtitle of your book, A Painter, A Poet, An Heiress, and a Spy. So let's talk about those characters, those people. Well, let's start with the painter, Peter Fleischmann, who really is the central character of this book.
Yeah.
Who is Peter Fleischmann? What's his background, his personality? What led him to Britain, and what led him to the camp?
Yeah, so Peter is he's 16 years old when he sort of enters the story of the book. He's living in Berlin. He actually comes from quite a wealthy family. His grandfather was a banker, and who had done very well from that until the Great Depression, which affects Germany as well, because many of the banks had their money in America. So there's that knock-on effect. And so he's reduced to poverty and then dies in the 1930s. And Peter is left without a carer because his parents, he's always been told, were murdered by the Nazis. They were anti-fascist journalists, and the steering of their car was apparently tampered with, and they drown in the Wannsee Lake. That's the story he's told for why he's got no parents. So in the In the early 30s, he goes to the Auerbach Orphanage in Berlin, becomes an orphan there. And then during the November pogroms, the British government, together with aid agencies, comes up with the very famous Kinder Transport initiative to try and take children out of the city. And because he's an orphan in Berlin, he qualifies, and he's under 17, he qualifies for a position on the very first train to leave Berlin with Berlin children on it. And so he comes to Britain. So there's this great irony where Peter has been rescued by the British state, given asylum and refuge in the country, and brought out by them. And he lands in Harwich on the Essex coastline and is put up by a family in Manchester, goes to live with them.
And it's actually kind of, because he's older, it's his life is a little bit more difficult maybe than some of the younger
orphans. Yeah, that's probably
because
true.
Their families are more willing to take them in.
Yeah.
So Peter has kind of a rough time when he first arrives to Britain, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of more nuanced side of the Kinder Transport story is that, in fact, when the appeals are put out for British families to come and take in, Kinder Transport children, have them live with them. And, they show a preference for young girls and blonde, sort of slightly mirroring the Nazis' own judgments on sort of Aryan standards, unfortunately. But so, yeah, you're right. Peter turns 17 quite soon after he arrives in Britain. And he's treated differently and he's put to work. But he's an aspiring artist. He was at an art college in Berlin before the Nazis say that Jewish children can no longer study there. And that's his dream. He's sort of designing posters. And when he gets to Britain, he gets this job working to colorize old photographs from the First World War, essentially. Once the mass internment policy comes into effect in May 1940, he's arrested along with many other people in Manchester where he's living at the time. He's taken to Worth Mills, that terrible cotton mill that I mentioned earlier. And from there, about 2 weeks later, he gets on the ferry that carries him across to the... he goes to another camp for a little while called Priestheath. But then after that, he goes on to Hutchinson on the Isle of Man. And he's... So that's the camp that he lands in. And it just so happens that Hutchinson has this very high density of accomplished artists who have also fled Germany. And so Peter has this slightly strange situation where for many of the men, they're experiencing a great deal of depression. They've been taken away from their families. They've been locked up indefinitely. There's been no trial. They've got no charge against them. And also they're fearing German invasion. Well, Peter's a bit younger and he's an aspiring artist, and he suddenly finds himself in this community of very well-known, in some cases world-famous artists who are also interned in the camp, who are, putting on art lessons and staging art exhibitions. And so he has quite an interesting time of it because for him, it's much more exciting.
Now, I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but I think it's definitely worth mentioning that Peter is actually a Jewish orphan, right?
Yeah.
So, and I thought this was very fascinating in your book that obviously he's put in the camp because he's, there's a suspicion that he could be spying for the German government.
Yeah.
But he is Jewish, and there are a lot of Jews who are put into the camp who are just completely opposed to obviously Nazism and the Nazi regime.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in fact, it was 80% Jewish people in the camp. And there's this great story that's passed around a lot by those who lived through this of arriving on the Isle of Man and overhearing a British officer say to his subordinate, I never had any idea that so many Jews were Nazis. And it just gives you a sense that, the complete lack of understanding of who these people were, of how they had come to be in Britain, and the German government's position towards them, where it wanted to strip their citizenship from them and eradicate them, both financially and, materially and in terms of their personhood as well. So it is the great irony. I think probably if you were interviewing a British government official who was working at that time right now, they would say, well, you know, we knew that the majority of people that we were interning were of no risk, but far better to just intern everyone and maybe catch a few spies that way, and then we can sort out who and release people thereafter, than not to intern anyone and let a few spies get away who are going to help with an invasion of Britain.
Yeah, that was kind of the attitude, right? Is like, cast this very wide net.
Yes.
And, you know, if there's 1,000 people and only one of them is a spy, then we've done our jobs. That was the attitude. But that's so crazy. You say 80% of the internees were Jewish then.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I forget, how was Peter discovered? Like, how did the authorities get to him? How did he draw attention to himself?
Well, I mean, he didn't. He was just like every other refugee who'd come to Britain. He was registered at the police station. They knew where he was living. They had a card for him, an enemy alien, on which it had stamped that he was a Category C. So he'd sat in front of one of these tribunals and been deemed by one of the most senior judges in the land to pose no risk to Britain. But none of that matters now with the mass internment policy. So they knew where to find him, and they went to arrest him. You know, in fact, in London, once word gets out of these arrests happening, some of the refugees go and they spend the daytime in the parks and in libraries because they know that the police are only doing arrests during working hours. So they managed to evade capture that way. But as I say, I think around 27,500 people are arrested in this way.
So Peter's journey then. So Peter gets arrested. And then he goes to one of the transit camps, Worth Mills, correct?
Yeah, he goes to Worth Mills, yeah.
And so he's there for about 5 days, really awful conditions. You talked a little bit about it, but you know, people are sharing beds and it's very cramped. And anyway, so Peter's in transit and then he ends up at Hutchinson Camp. What's Peter's story once he arrives at Hutchinson?
Yeah, so I mean, when he arrives at Hutchinson, the camp has been going for about 6 to 8 weeks, I think. So it's already quite a well-established setup. The British Army's policy was to basically make each camp quite an autonomous, self-governing unit. So the way the British Army had learned this technique, you know, when colonizing countries, whereby, you know, the best way to control a people is to, you know, join up with them, to appoint some of them as leaders, to self-manage themselves, and then you get far less trouble. And so the camp had its very own sort of it had a camp commandant who was voted for by the internees, and it had its very own clear hierarchy. And really, British soldiers didn't really enter the camp. They just let them get on with it, unless there was like a real big dispute or violence or anything like that. And what had happened at Hutchinson is, just 4 days after the camp opened, you know, because it had this high number of very accomplished individuals, including, you know, world famous lecturers, lawyers, artists, writers, journalists. It had a number of people who had fled Germany and taken up teaching posts at Oxford and Cambridge universities, you know, the very cream of the crop. And so there's this decision made in the camp, rather than just, we don't know how long we're going to be here for, we could be imprisoned indefinitely, rather than just waste our time, why don't we try and self-organize, I suppose, quite a German way of looking at things. Why don't we just, you know, come up with a schedule of lectures and we'll try and make the most of our time here. And that's what they do. There's an architect called Bruno Ahrens, and together with his assistant, Klaus Hinrichsen, who I mentioned earlier, he's the guy with the Morse code and the bed knocking. Together, they draw up this schedule of lectures each week, and they appoint a committee, and they call themselves Hutchinson Camp University. And what happens is, because they're situated around this square, some of the lecturers, you know, set up around the square, they get stools out and they stand on them and they start giving lectures about the subject in which they're an expert. And little crowds of internees gather around them and wander between lessons. And there are also musical performances. There was a very famous pianist in the camp, Marian Rivitz, who played in a piano duo that would play for the Prince of Wales and things like that. And he puts on a matinee performance, and the artists as well managed to persuade the British commandant of the camp, Captain Daniel, to give them space in which they can do their work and provide them with supplies. And so, yeah, by the time Peter arrives, it's quite an established community, I suppose, with its lots of events going on. There's chess, there's table tennis, there's a football team that plays against other teams from other internment camps. So there's a, you know, if you were a 17, 18 year old young person, there is quite a lot to be excited about, I suppose. Different situation if you are someone for whom, you know, your wife and your children are in London where the Blitz is happening. They've been left with no provider. Obviously, very different experience for them. But I think for Peter, it was generally quite an exciting time on the whole.
So this camp is not, it's this isn't what when most people think of World War II camps, you know, the camps in Germany come to mind, and just really poor, terrible conditions and slave labor. And this is not that. This is a place where, you know, even though people are imprisoned, there are communities springing up, and the internees are allowed to give lectures or study art or do different activities. Tell me about the conditions of Hutchinson Camp.
I should say that those comparisons were made between Worth Mills, the big converted oil factory that we mentioned. So the Red Cross send inspectors in, and in fact, there's a inspector goes in who had already visited the camps at Dachau and Buchenwald in Germany, and he says that the conditions in Worth Mills are worse than in those German camps. Now, obviously, you know, the purpose of the camps here is very different. You know, it's not to exterminate people; it's just to hold them until they can be sorted. So, you know, in that sense, yes, it's very different. But yeah, some of the conditions were equivalent, although not at Hutchinson. I would say it's different there.
Right. So so this is really these communities that spring up. It's, you know, they're all there, and so what are they going to do when they're there?
Yeah. Although, of course, there are stories of that happening as well in the Nazi concentration camps. So, you know, I think it's really, you know, just testament to human beings. You know, when you are put in those very difficult situations, you know, art and creativity. If you're an actor, you want to stage performances. If you're a painter, you want to paint. If you're a musician, you want to make music. Those are just very human reactions to imprisonment, I think. And so, you know, there are in terms of the cultural output of these camps, there are similarities between you know, the concentration camps and the internment camps.
We'll talk a little bit about the artist community at Hutchinson. Who were the artists there? What were they? What kind of art did they make?
Well, there was really a range of artists from all sorts of different disciplines. So you had people who were commercial poster artists, for example, like Willy Dubas was in the camp. So, for example, he would do, you know, fantastic Art Deco posters when he was working in Berlin to advertise holidays. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you had fine artists, like the most famous of whom is Kurt Schwitters, who was associated with the Dadaist movement, and you know, was famous enough that during the notorious exhibition that the Nazis staged mocking modern art, Schwitters had one of his paintings hung up, and Adolf Hitler in fact poses in front of it, and the picture appears in the newspapers. So you know, you've got someone of his stature is a genuine celebrity in the camp, someone like Schwitters. He's best known now for his collages that he made, but he at that time was also doing much more traditional portraits within the camp, you know, as a sort of hustle, tried to earn some money. He would charge people £3 to paint their head, £4 I think for head and shoulders, and £5 for a half figure. And anyone who had a bit of money in the camp would be able to basically get, you know, an internationally renowned artist to paint their portrait for them. And those who did very well out of it, because those paintings later are worth tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, and people got pretty creative too, right? I remember reading. There was an artist who would, the windows had like a film tint on them, and there was an artist who would cut out figures of I don't know, like animals and shapes and stuff. And that became like well known. So people became pretty creative with their surroundings.
Yeah, it was like a blackout film that was put on. So the actual blackout material that was supposed to be used had been lost in an attack by a U-boat that had sunk the ship carrying it. So they had to get creative and use this blackout film. And so, yeah, as you say, Helmut Weissenborn, who is he was best known as a lithographer, but he starts to cut shapes into the material, and it starts a craze in the camp, because you get people just, you know, making animals and all sorts of shapes, because it looks really nice when the sun shines and the rays come through the holes and the etchings that have been made in this material, and sort of bring light to the rooms.
Yeah, I think like one of the Jewish blocks even had him carve scenes, biblical scenes, into their windows.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, because it, you know, the rain, there was a wide range of Jewish people. So you had very Orthodox houses that tended to group together, that would not even turn their light switch off on the Sabbath. They would have to get someone else to come and do it for them, and would get in trouble for blackouts for that reason. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you would have people who perhaps just had one grandparent who was of Jewish extraction and in no way were practicing. But so all of that was accommodated. And then Schwitters as well gets very creative in the camp. He goes around and collects up the porridge after breakfast from loads of the different houses. People from the continent were not used to porridge as a breakfast food, so it would make it much too thick, and so it was almost inedible. And he'd go and collect up all the leftovers and use them to make a sculpture in his attic room, which after a few weeks starts to go off and
goes through the floor,
and is like dripping on the beds of the people below him, so causes a lot of disharmony in his house. But
Let's bring in some of the other people then from your title then, the poet, the heiress, and the spy. Talk about them and how they end up in this story.
Yeah, so Peter's story also intersects in quite interesting ways for when you're coming to tell a story like this with two other significant characters, one of whom is an heiress to the Kempinski fortune. Her name is Elizabeth or Aiken Kossen.
The restaurant hotel chain,
yeah, which is still around today. You can stay at Kempinski hotels all around the world, and so she is when she's trying to find a way out of Germany, essentially just before the war. She's certainly not an Orthodox Jew, but is on the Nazi list, not only because has Jewish blood, but also because they want to acquire her fortune. And she's trying to find a way out. And one of the ways she does this is by getting in contact with a chap called Ludwig Warschauer, who is a claims to be an inventor who enters her life in Germany and woos her, and they fall in love. And he says, look, I will get you out of Germany to Britain if you'll agree to marry me. And she says, yes, I'll do that. He also gets out her parents and also her children from her previous marriage. And so she manages to flee to Britain and then marries Warschau here. Now, Ecken knows Peter Fleischmann from their time in Germany, because Peter's very wealthy grandfather was friends with her. And so when he was a child, he would go and play at the Kempinski restaurants. And she looks after him. He'd go, and after his grandfather dies, Peter goes and stays with her family in the summer holidays. And so they've got quite a close relationship. Peter ends up years later in the camp in Hutchinson, and so too does this chap, Ludwig Warschauer, who arrives at the camp soon after it opens. And he's quite a boisterous character, very noticeable, and goes around boasting, you know, well, I'm a world famous inventor. There must be some mistake for why I've been interned. You know, I've got friends in high places. I'll just be here for a couple of days. And then he also lets slip, oh, and also I'm married to the wealthiest woman in Berlin, Ecken Warschauer. And Peter pipes up and goes, well, I know you're not. I know her. Like, I've stayed at her house. I know that you're not her husband. And so in this way, these three lives intersect in Hutchinson camp. It just so happens that Warschauer is also a suspected of being a Gestapo spy by MI5, the security services in Britain, and is subject to what is perhaps the longest investigation by the security services into any refugee during the Second World War. And so while he is busily, you know, sort of going around proclaiming how he's only going to be interned for very long, in fact, in London, there are two MI5 agents who are building up a massive file on him, on how he came to Britain, on how he happened to marry Ecken, and in how these three people, how their stories intersect in interesting ways.
Yeah, being married to the wealthiest woman in Berlin, you probably don't fly under the radar quite so easily.
Yeah. He was not trying to keep a low profile either. I mean, he was, you know, a big show off. And also, because he claimed to be this very, after a couple of weeks, he realizes he's probably not going to be released. And so he goes to the British officer, the camp commandant, and says, look, I'm a very excellent technical genius and inventor of things. Will you allow me to set up a technical school in the camp? And so he demands to be given a whole house where he can train up young internees in how to become engineers. And the commandant agrees to it and gives them this whole, so he then has, you know, lots of comforts associated with that. And it turns out he doesn't really do any teaching because he's not quite who he says he is, but he does manage to convince some of the real electrical geniuses in the camp to do the teaching for him. So manages to, you know, keep his position in this house for a few months at least.
So how do some of these characters, I guess we've been talking a lot about, well, how do they evolve over the, I guess it's 4 years? 4 or 5 years that this camp is running. How do these characters evolve?
Well, the camp really starts emptying of its brilliant individuals towards the end of 1940. The government, after the disaster that was the Arundora Star, public opinion in Britain changes towards the internment policy. There's more outcry. And of course, Britain's position in the war has changed. No longer does it look like the German army are going to invade from France? And so there's a bit less pressure now on the internment situation. So the government releases a white paper to start permitting those people who are deemed to be no risk to the British state to leave the camps. And there's also an opportunity for any internee who is fit enough to join the Pioneer Corps and actually show pledge their allegiance to Britain by serving in the army in this way. And so, yeah, you start to see releases happening. Peter applies to be released because he wants to go to art school in the UK, but it takes a very, very long time for anything to happen. And so while many of his friends and his tutors start to be released from the camp, he's left there languishing all the way through 1941 until eventually the refugee organisations manages to find him a place in Beckenham Art College in London, and he's finally released. So his story continues from there. You know, he's always dreamed of being this fine artist. While he's in the camp, he receives fantastic training from really brilliant people. He wins the camp art competition. He gets to display some of his works during the camp art exhibitions that are held there. You know, he takes life drawing lessons from Kirchfitters, things that just would have been impossible for him had he not been interned. And so, you know, some of this training really stands him in good stead when he's eventually released. And he goes on to study at the Royal College of Art in London. He graduates top of his year and is awarded with the Rome Scholarship, the highest accolade you can get, and then goes on to exhibit in Germany all around, after the war, all around the world, and takes on commissions for British universities and even the Royal Navy. He has a really interesting trajectory before the end of the war, however, because he joins the army to work as an interpreter, because he can obviously speak fluent German. And he is taken back to Worth Mills, the terrible camp that he is held in right at the beginning of his internment experience. Now it's been converted into a POW camp and is full of captured Nazis, some of the most dangerous, in fact, those who are most... committed to the Nazi cause are held in Worth Mills, and so he goes and provides translation for that. And at the end of hostilities, he returns to Berlin, and then he also works as a translator during the Nuremberg trials. So he's really present at all of these key moments during the Second World War, there for Kristallnacht, on the Kinder transport, in the internment camp, there at the end of the war in Berlin and at the Nuremberg trials. You know, for a real gift of a character, I think, for a writer like me who can take that full sweep through. I don't want to give too much about the, you know, Warschauer's story away, because that's some of the mystery is what happens to him and the truth of his story. But I'll leave that to readers to find.
Well, that's interesting with Peter being an interpreter. There was a story I remember hearing about here in America, Jewish refugees who had fled Germany in the 1930s, coming here and then getting recruited by the army by the government to go back to Germany, fight the Germans and serve as interpreters because their language skills were, you know, they could speak fluently. And so I've heard of similar stories here of Jewish refugees going back to Germany to interpret and to talk to a lot of these captured, just diehard Nazis, as kind of their effort towards one of the efforts towards the war.
Yeah, and of course, I think there's a lot of a lot of eagerness to return to Germany and see with their own eyes, what the end of the war and how what Germany's returning to and what its future is going to be like. You know, these were forced emigrations, weren't they? And so you can see why a person would be curious to see, to return to the places that they'd fled, really, in a moment of panic in many cases.
Now, what's the reputation of, so obviously Peter, you know, his career as an artist benefited from being at the camp.
Yes.
But I don't, does he, I can't imagine he feels fondly about, you know, being interned at such a young age, much like other people, or maybe that's not true. What's the reputation that these camps have in Britain today, and how do the internees, how do they often feel about their time there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's really, there's no consistent feeling towards the camp among the internees themselves. It would depend on a range of factors, you know, what your individual experience was like, whether you made friends in the camp. Well, really, in many cases, how old you were, because that would dictate the amount of investment you have in your life outside the camp. So if you're 17, 18 years old, it's a big adventure. You know, that's that part of life when you want to go and see the world and, you know, meet new people and all of that stuff. And you don't have much outside pulling you back. For older people with families and businesses, it was very different. And, you know, a huge amount of anxiety and stress and
fear.
At
the beginning, from what I understand, they couldn't, if you had a wife, like your spouse couldn't visit you. Now that changed.
Yeah, it was all difficult. Yeah. So, when you read the diaries that are written at the time, especially from, say anyone over the age of 30, they're filled with, they're quite dark documents. People are very depressed. It's a long sense of gloom, especially as other people start to be released and you're questioning, well, why am I not getting out? What have I done wrong? Who do I need to petition to help me get out? That view does, I think, start to soften in the post-war years. For example, Fred Ullman was a lawyer and an artist who was interned in Hutchinson. He wrote a diary, and when you read the original diary, it's very gloomy, it's very depressed. He edits his diaries at three times during his lifetime, and each time, a few decades later, and it gets softer and softer, and he takes out the edge, he smooths off the edges, and I think can maybe focus more on some of the positive outcomes or experiences that he had during that time. So it's not a static thing, however, how people, view their internment experience, especially after the war, when the full extent of the horrors of the Holocaust are revealed. It starts to throw the internment experience in a different light, I think, because you can say, well, there was this great injustice. I shouldn't have been interned. I was obviously a refugee. You should not have called me an enemy alien. You should have said I was a legitimate refugee from Nazi oppression. But then when you find out that perhaps family members or friends had died in the Holocaust, it makes complaining about it feel a bit different. And as well, many of these individuals want to make their life in Britain. They change their names from their German surnames to British English variants. They want to assimilate, and they're remaining furious at the British government for the internment measures, is not a good way to make peace with your new life circumstances. So I think that's a factor as well. But there are some people for whom definitely held a grudge. And there was one internee, Tristan Bush, who describes it as a war crime. I don't think many people would have agreed with that, many of the internees, but that just shows the range of responses that you could have. And yeah, I think in terms of the general public who were not interned, it's an episode that is not exactly suppressed, but it's not celebrated, it's not addressed. The British government doesn't issue any big apology for what happened, in contrast to the Canadian government, which has done that. The internment episode does not sit comfortably with the story that Britain likes to tell itself about its wartime character, which is one of a great just nation fighting the personification of evil. That is perhaps true, but it's more nuanced than that. Of course it is. Things are always more complicated. That's why I think you would struggle to find people who are aware of the full detail of what happened during the mass internment episode.
Yeah, and I think you're, throughout the book, you're rightly very critical of the British government at this time, and you're right that it doesn't match with the image that they want to portray of themselves as being very honorable in how they conducted themselves, as opposed to the Germans in the war.
Well, America has a part to play in that with Hollywood and the type of films that are being made in the 1950s. They're obviously celebratory about the Allied victory. And so it then starts to build a certain memory of the Second World War, particularly among, perhaps the children of people who fought in the war. The baby boomers start to have a particular view of what the war was like that's a little less nuanced than the truth.
Now, I know you said that the government has never apologized for the camps. What has the government done to atone for these camps?
So I believe there was an apology for what happened with the Arundora Star, the ship that was carrying internees, refugees, as well as POWs to Canada when many people died, and as well for the HMT Dunera, which is a notorious ship that was the one ship that went to Australia. There were terrible conditions on that ship and terrible looting by the British army officers of the internees. They took away their papers. It was just an appalling episode, and the British officers involved in that were court-martialed and held to account. Likewise, Major Alfred Braybrook, who was the commandant at Worth Mills, the terrible transit camp, he oversaw the looting of of the internees when they arrived, and they had valuables, money, wristwatches, typewriters stolen from them. He also said to the internees to keep them occupied. If you write down your stories, I'll make sure that they get sent to the government and they'll review your cases. Well, he then threw all of those bits of paper into the bin. It was just a way to sort of keep the internees occupied. He's also court-martialed for that and goes to prison for 6 months. So there were some consequences, but there was never sort of really a proper official acceptance that the government had failed to distinguish between legitimate threats and genuine refugees from Nazi oppression. You know, people who had already sat in front of these tribunals and been judged to pose no risk to the state shouldn't have been treated in this way, I don't think. And that should have been faced and acknowledged.
Do you think an apology will ever come?
I don't know. No. I don't.
Okay.
I think it's too far from the public conversation, the mainstream of conversation. It wasn't always like that. In 1940, this was the big topic of debate in government, in the Houses of Parliament. As you can go back and look at the transcripts, it's endlessly talked about in the House of Commons in London. But yeah, at some point it really fades from the national conversation. And I think many of the people to whom the apology should have been directed are no longer with us. There's very, very few internees who are still alive today. I did actually speak to one man who was an internee in Hutchinson who now lives in the States. He contacted me after my book was published over there and said, I was there. I was 16 at the time. He's, I think, 99 years old now. And so, yeah, there are a few, but very, very few. So I think perhaps regretfully that moment has passed.
What are you hoping that your readers take away from your book?
Well, I think, you know, this is a story about internment in 1940, but the question that underpins the book and that underpins this whole British political policy is how far can a nation go in the rightful defense of its values before it starts to abandon them along the way? You know, Britain is saying we're doing these internment measures in order to protect our democracy and our way of life. That's why. But of course, in doing so, you start to resemble the thing that you are fighting against. That's a question that will sit with every government forever. You know, it's a question that always will be with us. And so, yeah, you know, these are relevant conversations right now. You know, in Britain, we have refugees. There's a, you know, big political debate about refugees from Syria who are trying to escape to Britain on rafts, you know, often with a huge risk to their lives. And, you know, there are huge calls from the Conservative government here to stop those boats, to send people back. And the argument, I suppose, from people who believe in that nations have a responsibility to provide asylum when they can, would say, well, they're doing that because there are no legitimate routes for refugees to come to this country right now. It's far too difficult and there's no clear process. So, you know, these are debates that sit with us today. And I can imagine as well if Vladimir Putin was expelling his political rivals from Russia and they were coming to Britain en masse, much like they had from Germany in the 1930s, then there would also be perhaps concern that there would be, you know, FSB agents among that number. So, yeah, you can see how, you know, it would never be the exact same circumstances, but you can see how some of these political and military pressures might result in a similar set of circumstances again.
Well, this has been a wonderful interview, Simon. Thanks so much for joining me here.
My pleasure.
Before we wrap things up, let's talk about your next project, which I read is about Leningrad. I don't know if you've ever read the book City of Thieves by David Benioff, who actually created Game of Thrones, the TV series. Of course, right. George R. R. Martin wrote the book series. One of my favorite books. It's about two Soviets, a gentleman and a boy, who are sent by a Soviet general to go like find like two eggs in the middle of the siege of Leningrad for his daughters. Right. Wedding. It was such a good book. But I knew nothing about Leningrad before that. So I'm really excited for your project about Leningrad. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, I can. So the book's title at the moment, which may change, but I think it probably won't, is The Forbidden Garden of Leningrad. And it's about the Plant Institute. The world's largest seed bank at the time was in the middle of the city on St. Isaac's Square, with a quarter of a million seed and plant samples that had been gathered from every continent in the world. The siege begins in towards the autumn of 1941. The German army surrounds the city, really with the plan to starve the population into submission. It's a sort of way to claim Leningrad, which is now called St. Petersburg, of course, without having to, using the blunt, remote tool of war that is starvation and siege. And so by the winter of 1941, a notoriously cold, difficult winter where the city's supplies are running out, there's a mass death event where people across the city just start to die, perish because through starvation, which the Soviets refer to at the time as dystrophy, which is a sort of made up word that they use to describe what's happening. And at the seed bank, there's been a failed evacuation of the seeds and the samples. And so the botanists in charge of that building and that collection have this terrible moral dilemma. Do they distribute the seeds and the samples that they have to the starving people to prolong their lives for a few weeks? Or do they preserve the collection so that when the siege eventually breaks, they can plant the fields and feed a much greater number of people? So my book's about the scientists that had to make that terrible decision.
Well, when it comes out, I don't know if you have a timeline for when it's coming out. Do you have a date?
Next year. I'm not quite finished with the writing, but it's So I hope next year or early the year after, perhaps.
Well, when it does come out, I hope you will come back on my show.
Of course, yeah.
And talk about it because it sounds fascinating. Simon, where can people, if people want to get in touch with you, where can people find you? Are you on social media?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Simon Parkin. And you can also, I've got a website, simonparkin.com, where you can find a contact email and also links to the pieces I've written and my books as well.
Wonderful. Well, Simon Parkin, the author of The Island of Extraordinary Captives, a painter, a poet, an heiress, and a spy in World War II British. In a World War II British internment camp. Go buy the book. It's a great book. It's a great read. I really enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed this interview, Simon. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been great.